Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with officials confirming Turkish media reports that the suicide bombers who killed 45 people and wounded 240 at the Istanbul airport came from Russia, Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan, and speak with an expert on jihadism in Russia's Caucasus and the former Soviet Union, Gordon Hahn, a professor and researcher at the Terrorism Research and Education Program at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies in Monterey, the author of Russia's Islamic Threat and the Caucasus Emirate Mujahideen Global Jihadism in Russia's North Caucasus and Beyond. He joins us to discuss why the several thousand jihadis from Russia and the former Soviet Union who have joined the Islamic State or Daesh are so hardcore and are used as the tip of the spear in terms of asymmetrical warfare, which Daesh is resorting to more and more as it suffers mounting losses on the battlefield. Then Virginia Lopez joins us in the studio. She is a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for Al Jazeera English, and we will discuss the rapidly deteriorating situation in Venezuela, where Venezuelans are storming supermarkets and attacking food delivery trucks as basic food supplies and staples grow scarcer. We'll examine the looming collapse of an oil-rich country in an economic freefall, with political paralysis and next to no security for its citizens, as the National Guard can no longer control the long lines at the supermarkets, nor prevent journalists from covering the reality of everyday life that the government tries to censor and continues to deny. Then finally, we will look into the Fragile States Index of 2016, just released by the Fund for Peace, and speak with J.J. Messner, the executive director of the Fund for Peace, where he leads many of their security and human rights implementation programs. We will discuss which countries are the most fragile and which are the least, and alarming trends for the future of Europe following the refugee crisis and the Brexit vote. And joining us now is Gordon Hahn, who's a professor and researcher in the Terrorism Research and Education Program at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey. He has taught at several universities in the United States and as a Fulbright Scholar at St. Petersburg State University in Russia. And his books include Russia's Islamic Threat and Russia's Revolution from Above. And his latest book is The Caucasus Emirate Mujahideen, Global Jihadism in Russia's North Caucasus and Beyond. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gordon Hahn.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And Gordon, the Turkish authorities are now revealing that the three suicide bombers that shot up and blew up the airport in Istanbul are from Russia and from Uzbekistan and Kyrgyzstan. They've identified one of the men as Osman Vadinov. And they've also identified another, at least Turkish media has identified the organizer of the attack, whose name is Ahmed Chatayev, a Chechen believed to have acted as an ISIS recruiter who is apparently on the U.S. counterterrorism sanctions list. So what do you make of the Russian connection to the bombings at the Istanbul airport?
Well, it's not very surprising because the North Caucasus, the former so-called, it still exists, the Caucasus Emirate of the North Caucasus, in Russia's North Caucasus, has been longstanding, had ties first to Al-Qaeda, then it began to develop ties to the Islamic State, and eventually a branch broke off and joined the Islamic State just last year, and led by their emir from Dagestan. So it's also not surprising that Vadinov actually is from Dagestan, Chatayev is from Chechnya. Another factor is that Turkey has been a transit route for a long time for Chechens, either hiding from Russian law enforcement and some Dagestanis and others from the North Caucasus. And it's been a main transit route to and from Syria back to Russia. So people have been leaving the North Caucasus, going through Turkey to Syria and Iraq, and then vice versa, returning. So there was nothing to prevent them from stopping in Turkey, and this was actually absolutely inevitable. This kind of attack involving people from the North Caucasus would occur.
So when Vladimir Putin said back in October that there are between 5,000 and 7,000 Russians or people from Russia, which would include Chechnya, who have joined jihadist movements, and I imagine that's mostly the Islamic State, what do you make of those numbers, Gordon Hahn?
Well, I think those numbers are a little high. It could be as many as 5,000. I don't think it's up to 7,000. I'm trying to remember back now. He may have been referring to fighters from across the former Soviet Union.
Yeah, he was. Yes, yeah.
So that would be, you know, that would make more sense, because there are a lot from many from Central Asia. And there are also many from Russia's Tatarstan and Bashkortostan, not quite as many. And then, of course, the largest group would be people from the North Caucasus, especially Dagestan and Chechnya. So that's probably a fairly accurate figure.
So what makes, though, these, particularly the Chechens, the kind of the tip of the spear in jihadism, assuming that these three that were sent to blow up the airport in Istanbul, presumably by the Islamic State next door in Raqqa, in Syria, they were sort of like commandos, shock troops, the cream of the crop. Is that, am I right in suggesting that there's something about the Chechens that make them the most sort of highly motivated and lethal amongst the terrorist international diaspora?
I think the Chechens are certainly up there. It would be a mistake to count out the Dagestanis. And that really goes back all the way back to the late 19th century when Russia was trying to take control over the North Caucasus. And the two leading imams who led the resistance were actually from Dagestan, not from Chechnya, though Chechens certainly are fierce fighters, and the number of fierce fighters was certainly increased by the two post-Soviet wars. Plus the Chechens and the Dagestanis, most of the mountain peoples in the North Caucasus and many other places in parts of the world, and even Scotland, not in terms of Islamic terrorism, but in terms of just being tough fighters, that's sort of run-of-the-mill for mountain peoples. But it's particularly true, I think, for the North Caucasus. And then when you add the, you know, layer on top of Islamic radicalism, it creates an even more fierce problem.
Well, you know, you only have to read Tolstoy's short story, The Cossacks, to see the depth of the hatred and wars that went on between the Russians and the Chechens, these green-eyed devils, as Tolstoy describes them.
Right, the Haji Murad and so forth, mm-hmm. and so on. Yeah, I mean, there's a long tradition of, on the one hand, disdain between the two peoples. On the other hand, there's sort of a, at least on the side, on the Russian side, a sort of guarded respect for the North Caucasus fighting peoples. And in fact, there's a very famous painting of the surrender of Shamil, who was one of the Dagestani imams leading the resistance in the late 19th century that I talked about earlier, in which depicts his arrest, his capture, and all the Russian officers standing around and looking at him with, you know, respect and a sense of honor towards him. And in fact, he was never executed. He was given a nice exile in a fairly nice home, and he eventually communicated to the North Caucasus peoples that they should cease the resistance.
And again, I'm speaking with Gordon Hahn, who's a professor and researcher in the Terrorism Research and Education Program at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey. He has taught at several universities in the United States and as a Fulbright Scholar at St. Petersburg State University in Russia. And his books include Russia's Islamic Threat and Russia's Revolution from Above. And his latest book is The Caucasus Emirate Mujahideen, Global Jihadism in Russia's North Caucasus and Beyond. So, given that Putin is fighting the Islamic State, although he's also really fighting the Free Syrian Army and the Western-backed rebels more intensely, but nevertheless he is to some extent engaged against the Islamic State, would that be a motivator for these Chechens within the Islamic State or Daesh's umbrella?
Certainly that it would attract more fighters to the Islamic State and to other groups in Syria and Iraq. But it's important actually to clarify one thing. It's been widely reported what you just stated, that Putin is largely fighting people from the Free Syrian Army. And actually, that's not the case. Most of the attacks that Putin's carried out have been against Jabhat al-Nusra, which is not part of the Free Syrian Army and is a radical Islamist group tied to al-Qaeda. And then about 20% of the attacks that have been carried out by the Russians have been against the Islamic State. Very few attacks have been carried out against moderate forces, but that's because there are very few moderate forces to begin with, contrary to what the United States has been claiming for a couple of years. Most groups are radical Islamists and jihadists. I mean, the most moderate group, aside from a few handful of maybe socialists and Democrats in the resistance, are the Muslim Brotherhood, and they're simply people who are fighting for the same goals that Al-Qaeda and Islamic State are fighting for, but they just want to use different methods.
Right. Well, there's no question that Putin is not kind of lost in the sort of fractionalizing, following all of these various hundreds of little jihadi groups that we seem to be sort of worried about and trying to figure out. He doesn't make much distinction between the Islamic State and al-Nusra, which is, after all, an Al-Qaeda group. So in many ways, I think Putin has a much clearer picture of who the enemy is in Syria.
That's true.
But let's, though, try and figure out here what the threat is. I mean, the Russians don't let these guys back, do they? I mean, Tunisia lets them back, and other countries let them come back, return. Russia doesn't let them return. So was there any element of the Russians at a while back letting these guys go to Syria because they figured, you know, they're better out of our hair?
There may have been some willingness to let some of them go, but I don't think it was some anti-Russian propagandists who tried to claim that there was an organized effort by the FSB to send people there. I think, generally speaking, it's not in Russia's interest to have these guys go there because it helps them first develop networks among international terrorist groups, and second of all, it gives them opportunities for training and financing, and then they can return. And in fact, they do return. Many have been arrested, and many have returned, and a few of them have been able to carry out the very few small number of attacks that have been occurring in the last year or so in Dagestan and a very few in Chechnya. So the numbers have gone way down since the fighters started going to Syria and Iraq. And another consequence, another factor is that the movement is now divided. The Caucasus Emirate lost more than 80% of its fighters and emirs when they left the Caucasus Emirate and joined the Islamic State and became the so-called Caucasus Vilayet of the Islamic State. So they joined ISIS. So it's a more complicated picture than that.
But still, Gordon Hahn, the assumption here is that because the Islamic State is being pounded and a big convoy was just shot up escaping from the most recent battle in Fallujah, the assumption is that Obama's pledge that he was going to degrade and destroy the Islamic State may well be happening, and that therefore they resort to asymmetrical warfare by attacking soft targets like the Istanbul airport. Would you agree with that assumption?
Oh, there's no doubt about it that that's been their modus, the jihadists, modus operandi, whether it's Al-Qaeda or Islamic State or others, for years. So, you know, that's hardly surprising. The more interesting factor is the location. You know, that Turkey has basically set itself up by first looking the other way regarding the Islamic State and helping some of the other jihadist groups, and now that's coming back to bite them.
Well, one only hopes that the Turkish people will wake up to what a disaster President Erdogan has been in that regard. But unfortunately, under circumstances like this, where there's a terrorist attack on a country, they tend to rally around the flag and probably, you know, give him a pass on that. What's your understanding of Turkish politics?
I'm not a major expert on Turkish politics, but generally speaking, the opposition, except for the more Islamist or Islamic opposition, might not be so sanguine about rallying around the flag and so forth. And Erdogan's been carrying out, you know, what might be called a slow Shariaization of Turkish society and law. So in some ways, he's encouraging or creating a larger pool for recruits. And of course, the main problem is that he hasn't done anything to crack down. And this is probably part of his calculation to gain leverage over Russia and other states such as Syria, was to let these fighters travel back and forth between the former Soviet Union in Syria. And this was inevitably bound to come back and bite him, because there's nothing to prevent them from wanting to attack the Turkish state and society. And in fact, given the fact that the regime, the overall regime in Turkey, is the Ataturk regime, which basically secularized an Islamic state and Islamic caliphate, the Ottoman Empire, there's very good reason to take revenge against Erdogan in Turkey, right?
Right. Well, it's just that he's proving to be such a disaster in such a key country. And he started out, of course, with the zero problems with neighbors policy, and he has nothing but problems with every neighbor, including Russia, who he's now apologized to. But I don't see the Russian tourists coming back, do you, particularly following this bombing at the airport?
Yeah, I don't think there's going to be a major flood of Russian tourists. There probably will be some courageous souls who will decide to go to Turkey. Russians are, after all, sort of like Brits in some ways, with the stiff upper lip. So they might probably will be some uptick in tourists. But basically, Erdogan has walked into this, and by, you know, instead of using really soft power in his, no enemy neighbors policy, he basically started getting involved in the use of harder power by getting involved, joining in the civil war against Assad. I think he got overambitious and thought he saw an opportunity to expand Turkish power and even stretch out the borders a bit, according to some interpretation. So, overextended himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the record's pretty clear. The guy's been a disaster.
Absolutely.
But just in closing, Gordon Hahn, U.S. and Russia are effectively allies in Syria. At least they're working off the same playbook, it would seem. How do you see this incident affecting things in any way?
Well, one would think that it would begin to wake up some eyes inside Turkey, and being that Turkey's a NATO member, maybe there'll be some softening of positions, though probably not very likely within NATO. Probably a better lesson for an incoming administration in the United States that might continue attacks like this, and others might create more of a inclination to try to patch up some of the relationship with Russia. We'll have to see on that score. More likely with Trump than with Clinton.
Well, I think the country would have to pay a high price to have better relations with Russia, to have put Trump as America's president.
Yeah. Either way, I think the American people are going to be paying a high price after this election, no matter who wins.
Okay, well, on that note, Gordon Hahn, I thank you for joining us.
Okay, thank you very much, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Gordon Hahn, who's a professor and researcher in the Terrorism Research and Education Program at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies at Monterey. He's taught at several universities in the United States and is a Fulbright Scholar at St. Petersburg State University in Russia. And his books include Russia's Islamic Threat and Russia's Revolution from Above. And his latest book is The Caucasus Emirate Mujahideen, Global Jihadism in Russia's North Caucasus and Beyond. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back joined by the Caracas-based journalist Virginia Lopez, talking about the dire situation in Venezuela.
Porque está viejo y cansado, pero no se dan de cuenta que un corazón amarrado, cuando le sueltan las riendas, es caballo desbocado. Y si una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a faceta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran pasas riendas.
And joining us now in the studio is Virginia Lopez, who's a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for Al Jazeera English. Welcome to Background Briefing, Virginia Lopez.
Thanks.
And Virginia, it's lovely to have you in person. We've spoken a lot over the years as you've described your country, essentially, what can I say, is heading into more and more chaos, and to the point where it appears to be circling the drain. There doesn't appear to be, I mean, I know there's a standoff between the opposition controlling the Congress and the presidency, but in general, do you think that there is any authority in charge? Has Maduro or whatever organs of state exist to create security for the people, are they functioning anymore? How close to chaos or anarchy is it?
There's a general mistrust in state institutions. We've just been covering the validation process all across the country, and so had the chance to visit several small towns, poor neighborhoods, middle-class neighborhoods, and the one common thread is that all around, just people do not trust the government at all whatsoever. And this was...
And does that mean both the opposition and Maduro?
Absolutely, yes. There was a sense that, well, people were very motivated to kickstart this recall referendum. And I think that that's basically, a lot of people were looking at this as like the last hope for a democratic transition out of a situation that they describe as being, like you said, very close to anarchy. But we were speaking to people who weren't lining up to validate their signatures, but rather standing in line for, you know, 5 and 6 hours just to get food. And this general mistrust, like I said, was the common thread throughout the whole story that we were covering. I think what we have now is, like you said, initially this was a political standoff between government and opposition, but now it's more of a social and economic crisis taking over what had been deeply polarized society. So that, in you know, this political crisis is no longer people's priority. It's almost like in the backdrop.
But if you have, as apparently the Washington Post just recently reported, you have Venezuelans storming supermarkets and attacking trucks with food supplies, this is really the sign of the wheels coming off. Is there anybody, and traditionally, unfortunately, in Central and South American countries, when you have this kind of chaos, the military tends to step in? Do you see that as a possibility?
The military has, you know, they describe themselves as being, amongst many things, revolutionary. So, you know, that's a sort of a clear indication that they're loyal to the government. Although
well, Chavez came out of the military, didn't he?
Correct. Yeah. And there's a strong alliance between the military and several politicians. In fact, I want to say 1/3 of the governors currently in power are ex-military men. So it's a very heavily military government, no? Mm-hmm. But the Minister of Defense has also, up to this point, remained somewhat institutional in his approach, no? I think they're also facing increased a challenge at this point because they're having, you know, you've got a very volatile social situation that would call for possible military intervention against people. So, you know, they're more mm-hmm. and more their position is being challenged. I think, you know, that I can only guess that they're somewhat desperate to solve this food scarcity situation or this economic crisis or collapse. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, you have the opposition also pressuring them and saying, you know, you're basically for democracy and for ensuring that the institutions are doing their job, or you are for a government that is losing legitimacy. So, you know.
Right. So who is keeping the peace in front? Who's standing guard in front of supermarkets where there are long, long lines of people? Who's responding, if anybody, to attacks on food trucks and this looting of supermarkets?
Well, in theory, it's the National Guard, but something really interesting has happened. It used to be that journalists couldn't film food queues, and the National Guard would enforce this, and we were often, you know, told to drop our cameras or even, you know, physically removed. But more and more, the people standing in line are actually asking us to film and coming in between us and the National Guard and actually demanding that the National Guard leave us to do our work because, you know, and people say that, you know, we want people to know what's going on. And the other really interesting thing is that these protests for food On one hand, there's looting, but there's also a social protest to this element. People are demanding food without necessarily trickling into violence and looting. There are some small, very widespread cases of looting. I think there's, according to the Observatory of Social Conflictivity, it's something like 10 incidents of looting and supermarkets being ransacked on one given day across the country. But again, there's also a lot of social content to these protests and people just simply saying, look, you know, we want food. So, you know, it's a desperate, dire situation.
And again, I'm speaking with Virginia Lopez, who is joining us in the studio. She's a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for Al Jazeera English. So it is also, and it's difficult to get your head around the idea that an oil-rich country with, I think, the largest, if not the second largest oil reserves in the world, could be in these dire straits. Obviously, the price of oil has gone down precipitously, and this largely led by the Saudis, but it is starting to creep back up. What's being done in terms of the oil sector? Is it as if you can't get food in the supermarkets, does that mean that they're not maintaining the wells and infrastructure?
Basically, production has dropped, which is unbelievable, you know, given the fact that we've just come from a decade of record high oil prices. Clearly, this indicates that, you know, mismanagement was rampant, that there was no investment in infrastructure or in maintenance. And this is also happening, and I think it's important to underline this, that this is happening in a state-run oil company that prided itself in being amongst the best-run companies in the world. So it's just, you know, we're seeing basically, just the murder of the hen of the golden eggs, or the...
laying the golden eggs, yeah. Being throttled to death.
Exactly, yeah. Because Venezuela relies on oil revenue for 95% of its income, and we're losing that every day. Mm-hmm. And just to give you an idea, when I interviewed the Ministry of Energy 5 years ago, he was expecting oil production to be at around 4 million barrels a day by 2015. Not only has Venezuelan production failed to meet that target, but there's just, you know, we're heavily in debt with all of the service providers, Schlumberger, Halliburton. So again, the sense of recovering this industry is just really difficult to imagine that this is going to happen in the near future.
But I understand they mortgaged a lot of oil in the ground to the Chinese with massive loans. When are the Chinese going to call these loans? What's the position of Venezuela's biggest creditor, which I believe is China?
Well, there was something really interesting that happened this week and sort of somewhat unreported. One of the leading figures in the opposition was invited to China. And I think that is fair to sort of infer that he's going to informally meet with the Chinese government, who's declared a sort of a 2-year moratorium on the Venezuelan debt. I think this sort of signals that the Chinese are very worried about, you know, what's going on in Venezuela and whether this debt will be honored. And they're beginning to also recognize that the opposition could soon somehow be in power. So they're sort of, you know, drawing these links, trying to ensure that their debt will be paid, no?
Right. Now, the U.S. is still the biggest recipient of oil. So it's not like the Chinese could get their debt recovered through oil shipments.
You'd have to have a production to begin with.
So that's the problem. The production is the production, you know, barely covering domestic market? Because, you know, you have this weird situation in Venezuela where gasoline is subsidized, where it's only, 5 cents a gallon. I think they raised it maybe to 10 cents or something.
Yeah, they raised it by something like 3,000%, and it's still the cheapest petrol in the world. And it's still, I don't know, at the black market rate, it's $3 to fill up a tank of, I don't know, 40 liters. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that these are a lot of deals that are happening behind closed doors. So it's sort of difficult to give you a precise answer. But Venezuela is beginning to even import crude because in order to sort of process the crude that Venezuela produces, it needs to blend it. So for the first time last year, Venezuela was no longer able to provide itself with this light weight crude to refine the heavyweight crude. So it's incredibly uncertain, but and ironic, given the fact that Chavez prided himself in saying that he had somehow nationalized the oil industry and that he had somehow expelled so many of these foreign oil companies. And I think what we'll be seeing is actually the return of a lot of transnationals who are now going to buy or will have preferential treatments because the country's desperate for revenue.
Well, let's turn to what it's like just to live in a country that has, I think certainly the hemisphere's highest crime rate. No, maybe Honduras is worse, but it's really up there. And it's been going up for some time. And you've got food shortage and stuff. You're here visiting the United States with your children. But I imagine, as a mother and as a citizen of a country that is becoming more and more lawless, how do you navigate your day? Because I understand you and your husband were mugged, held up, that you also, in the middle of the night, you woke up to burglars inside the house. Mercifully, they didn't do anything to you physically, but your neighbors were murdered in their beds. So how do you endure this? And how does the average citizen deal with this? Even those that believed in the revolution and whose lives were improved by the revolution. A lot of poor people's lives were uplifted. You have to give Chavez credit for that. On the other hand, these same people are living in sort of favelas or whatever. I don't know what the local word for it is, but they're living in a war zone, from what I understand.
It's a desperate situation. It's life with fear and not an irrational imaginary fear, but rather a very concrete fear that comes at you from all sides. If you're not worried about being killed just because you walked down the road of your middle-class neighborhood, it's the fear that your children will not have a future, or the fear that your best friends are all leaving. So it's a terrible, debilitating situation, especially because I was born there and I grew up in a country that was so dramatically different from what I'm seeing now. As a journalist, I often speak to people who describe the destruction of a country that my parents helped to build. And I just get the sense that, the past is no longer there because the hydropower plant that my father-in-law and that my mother helped build is now in tatters, or the health sector and the public hospitals that my father took so much pride in contributing to build are now, an abomination. So I get the sense that there's no past and there's no future. And so, it's a common thread in a lot of the interviews that I conduct and a lot of the people that I speak to. Just to give you an idea, we'll be speaking to people in the most dire poverty-like conditions. And when I ask them the same question you've asked me, they all think of leaving the country, because if they're lucky, they're Colombian immigrants who, left their country that was war-ridden looking for a better life in Venezuela, which was, like I said, it was like the Switzerland of Latin America. And now they're in their 50s, in their 60s, and they're having to think of uprooting to move back to Colombia. So I think that this isn't the middle class leaving the country. This isn't the privileged elite leaving the country. This is everybody wanting to leave the country. And I think this really speaks to the fact that this notion of future is very hard to imagine, no?
Well, obviously, a lot of the destruction of Venezuela and the hopes and dreams of revolution, which, by the way, a lot of leftists in the rest of the world, particularly here in the United States, are very invested in. I mean, I did an interview a year or so ago with Tariq Ali, who's a famous sort of 60s radical, and he was saying how terrible capitalism is. And I said, well, what alternatives are? And he said, well, the Russians and the Chinese are gangster capitalism. And I said, well, what place in the world would you say has got it right? Mm-hmm. And he said, Venezuela. And I thought, good Lord, he's delusional, The problem is that so many people are delusional about the ideas. The romance of the revolution was undeniable, but the reality of the revolution is something that we're dealing with here in the United States, which you could call Trumpism. Mm-hmm. It's the idea of a populist leader who has no
qualifications, who's erratic, perhaps even mentally unstable, and yet is able to charismatically seduce a whole country into believing that they're going to make their lives better. And for a while, of course, Chavez did, particularly for the poor. But in a sense, is that a correct analogy that this is the wreckage of populism?
I think that we will look back at what happened in Venezuela and regrettably consider it the worst thing that's happened to the left. I think that this is a government that not only is corrupt, but that also corrupted a lot of sectors of society. Like I said, you know, people mistrust institutions. This is a country that, or this is a state that voluntarily relinquished the monopoly of violence, which is, you know, it's sort of the founding or the sine qua non condition to a state. It's, you know, we have armed groups and they were armed by the government. And yes, there were social gains, but they weren't sustainable. You know, where are they now? We're having to queue for food. I can't see anything more dramatic than a country that can't feed its own people, not to mention give them a health system or an education. So again, you know, yes, we can recognize the social gains, but they weren't sustainable in the long run. So I don't, I don't, you know, to me that one of the ways of evaluating how successful you are is whether this has been sustainable in time.
Right, but obviously this was a left-wing Cordillo as opposed to the usual Latin American right-wing Cordillo. But there's still, as far as I can see, and I may be wrong in this, and correct me if I am indeed, the idea, you know, we're alarmed about the possibility of Trump. Mm-hmm. We've never seen a kind of Duce-type character in American politics, at least I don't think we have. And yet he's seducing an awful lot of people with empty promises. Now, is there an analogy there?
Well, certainly I think that their TV personality is very similar. You know, I always think that Chavez wrote the headline. You know, he was a master of...
He didn't have to get free media because he controlled it, right?
Yeah, that
and
too.
And they're eventually at the point now where they just about control everything now, the government, don't they?
Correct, yeah. Right. And this was actually like an explicitly stated... policy that they would have communicational hegemony.
Right.
I definitely think that you guys are now confronted with sort of this like strongman or caudillo type figure, you know, right, where he breaks all of the rules, and that somewhat
and also talks in a very kind of crude way, which was part of Chavez's charm, wasn't it? If indeed that's the right word.
Yeah. Well, I think certainly people thought that the sort of no-nonsense approach was, you know, for a population that was tired with conventional politics was appealing. I think that the danger here is that leaders tend to become templates for society. And I certainly saw a whole generation begin to imitate Chavez in his coarseness or in his folksiness. And yes, and there's definitely the sort of populist, like we're going to destroy the establishment and build a new sort of way of doing things that Trump is trying to emulate. I can just warn you guys.
Right, but it's not as if Venezuela, before Chavez, you know, was a place that needed reform, clearly. I mean, and there was an oligarchical kind of structure there. And it's not as if in the United States, working people are finally waking up to the fact that they're getting shafted. You know, they've got messages from both Bernie Sanders on the right and on the left and Donald Trump on the right about that. And it's clearly resonating. So these people don't exist come out of nowhere. There is a
sentiment, yeah.
Sentiment in the population.
I know. Especially in the U.S., you're seeing, I think, a very sort of privileged elite that doesn't necessarily pay taxes. And the whole sort of Panama Papers, I think, also revealed the extent to which Russian oligarchs or, you know, Latin American presidents or leaders were, you know, somehow finding a way away from paying taxes. Also, paying for a service that not everybody can afford. So. Clearly. I mean, there's a growing disillusionment, and I think rightly so, that the rich are getting richer and the poor are either going to jail or getting poorer, no? And I can see that would be a growing disappointment. But again, you know, I don't know that Trump is going to somehow remedy that, especially because of the sector of society he belongs to. And it's, like I said, certainly in Venezuela, you know, things weren't perfect when Chavez came to power. That, and certainly, I think that explains why somebody like Chavez was attractive to so many people, because Chavez won with 70% of voter approval. I just think this was a wasted opportunity, you know, not only in terms of the popularity Chavez had, but also the oil prices that he enjoyed. You know, this could have been the decade where Venezuela became a better country, no?
Well, just in closing in the last minute, Virginia Lopez, obviously there doesn't seem to be any effort or any mechanism to stop this trajectory. An outside influence, I'm not sure, at least in Nextdoor and Colombia, there's been a peace treaty. That's an achievement. But and whether these people who say that have escaped for this civil war in Colombia might return. But in general, is there anything you can leave us with that gives us some idea that we're not going to be seeing even worse images? You know, even though, as you point out, you've been censored, in effect, as reporters from showing how things are falling out, how the wheels are coming off.
Well, the opposition has basically passed the first stage in order to kickstart this recall referendum that could see President Nicolas Maduro leave power earlier than or before his term ends. The crucial aspect to this recall referendum is that if indeed it does pass the second stage, it takes place in 2016, because according to the Constitution, if this were to take place after January the 10th of next year, then Maduro's vice president would assume power. Now, again, this could mean that there's a sort of softer transition where both the opposition and the government somehow reach a middle ground. Or it could also mean that Venezuela is not able to recover the trust of markets, and you know, there things like much-needed loans don't take place. No, there's also, you know, Venezuela's due to make bond payments in November, and apparently Barclays, for example, thinks that Venezuela will meet this payment, but if not, we'd be faced with default. So.
Well, it sounds like, curiously enough, a situation analogous to what we have here in the United States, where Hillary Clinton is blessed by the fact that she's running against Donald Trump, and Chavez and Maduro have been blessed by a pretty feckless opposition as well. So
they're each other's best friends,
there
it
you
seems.
Go. Well, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate your coming into the studio.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Virginia Lopez, who's a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for Al Jazeera English. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the Fragile States Index of 2016. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is J.J. Mesner, who's the Executive Director of the Fund for Peace, where he leads many of their security and human rights implementation programs. And you have just released the Fragile States Index of 2016, which covers events in 2015. So first of all, welcome to Background Briefing, J.J. Mesner.
Thanks, Ian.
And in terms of your latest Fragile States Index, we've talked to you before about previous years. So what's different then about the 2016 report, which of course covers the events of 2015?
Well, I think one of the most interesting things that we've found in the 2016 Fragile States Index is, as many of your listeners may know, frequently when we talk about the Fragile States Index, we'll be looking at countries like Syria with its civil war, or in the past Libya, or perhaps countries like DR Congo or Zimbabwe, or countries in Africa that are experiencing severe pressures. But this year, much of the attention is on Europe. And as we've seen in the headlines over the past year or more, with the intense pressure that refugee flows have placed on certain European countries, we've seen that pressure really manifested in the numbers of this year's index. The fact that of the most worsened countries this year, that a European country, Hungary, is the most worsened for 2016, I think is a marked departure from many of the findings that we've had in the past.
But when you talk about fragility in Hungary, is that about the state itself disintegrating, or is it about the atmosphere, if you will, for the want of a better description, in the state? Because already you have a right-wing government under Viktor Orban, and you have on his right you have the Jobbik party, which is extremely neo-fascist. The gypsies are being beaten up, liberals are being beaten up, etc. So how do you index fragility in that context?
Well, I think you phrase it perfectly. I think that the atmosphere very much is what is bringing down Hungary's score. It is easy to look at the refugee crisis and to presume that it might be having an all-encompassing effect on a country, but certainly with Hungary, it is a cumulative effect. It is not only the refugee crisis, but it's also the policy responses to that refugee crisis. And beyond that, you rightly point out that Hungary is becoming increasingly illiberal due to the policies of Viktor Orban and the Jobbik party. And so I think that the pressures on Hungary, as much as they may be external from refugee flows, they are in many ways self-inflicted as well. And I think that we're going to see a worsening trend for Hungary continue, largely because of those continuing internal pressures.
But in terms of the last few years of Fragile States Index reports that you've done, J.J. Messner, it seems to me, particularly when you look at the Brexit vote, which caught everybody by surprise, all the punditry and all the analysts, etc., and much of the anxiety that was spread by the Leave campaign featured pictures of flows of migrants in Europe, which was a lot of criticism because it was a distortion of the situation. But nevertheless, it fed into a kind of paranoia, if you will. And I can't help sort of tracing all of this back to the Bush-Cheney intervention in Afghanistan and Iraq, that isn't all of the chaos, and after all, to begin with, much if not most of the refugees pouring into Europe come from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria. So there's a direct connection there. But the sort of domino effects of the Bush-Cheney breaking the China, as Secretary of State Colin Powell warned them, once you break it, you own it. Well, in the case of the US, they broke it, but they've kind of disowned it. And it's now become everybody's problem.
Well, I think that you're right to point out that the current instability in the Middle East and North Africa also, and not to mention South Asia, is really causing intense pressure through not only regional instability, but through refugee flows as well. And I think that certainly it can be argued that certain U.S. policies may have contributed to that instability, certainly I think that there's many other pressures within the region that have contributed also. One thing I would like to do is just pick up on one thing that you mentioned before, which is the Brexit vote. And you're right that in many ways this has come as an enormous surprise to many pundits. And in that sense, we went back and looked at the trends for the United Kingdom, and we actually did find some interesting trends in our Fragile States Index data for the UK. First of all, for a campaign that was, for a Leave campaign, that was based so much on immigration and refugees, our data had actually been demonstrating that the refugee pressures on the United Kingdom had been improving for the last several years, which is to say that from the point of view of our data, the issue was really not as significant as the Leave campaign made out. The United Kingdom overall had been improving across most indicators. However, what is most concerning is that one specific indicator for the UK had been going in the other direction, and that is group grievance, which has been deteriorating significantly for the last 5 years in the United Kingdom. And that focuses on internal divisions between different parts of society, whether it be based on ethnicity, religion, creed, whatever group you might define, that there are schisms that are opening up within British society. And I think that that is not only very concerning, but I think we are seeing those divisions being manipulated by various political forces within the UK.
Well, let's again remind the audience, if I may, that I'm speaking with JJ Messner, who's the executive director of the Fund for Peace, where he leads many of their security and human rights implementation programs. And the Fund for Peace have just published their annual Fragile States Index of 2016, which covers events in 2015. And let me start just on the list here to sort of give our audience the good news, if you will. Not that the U.S. is at the top of the list, in other words, the least fragile. It's at 162. Canada's at 169. And then the five countries that are the least fragile, if you will, are Australia, Switzerland, Denmark, New Zealand, Norway, and Finland being the least fragile, if you will. At the other end of the poll, Somalia is the most fragile, followed by South Sudan, Central African Republic, Sudan, Yemen, and Syria. But then in the midst of it, in the middle, you've got countries that we just got through talking to a journalist who's just back from, lives in Venezuela, describing a country that's poised on the brink of collapse, and yet it's at 63. Papua New Guinea is a country that barely is on the global radar, but nevertheless is disintegrating into anarchy, and that's at 50. And Saudi Arabia, where it has enormous internal tensions, is at 97. So this is to be at the top of the list. In other words, the most fragile states on the planet, given some of those states in the middle that I just mentioned, it's got to be hell on earth in these countries.
Well, certainly the internal situation in a number of countries, as you rightly identify, is certainly very concerning. One thing that I would flag for your listeners in looking at the rankings is, first of all, to remember that our index, just by nature of looking at a calendar year sample from the 1st of January to the 31st of December of any given year, there is somewhat of a time lag. So certainly with a country like Venezuela or Papua New Guinea that have both, I think, deteriorated markedly in the last 6 months, not that they were in a particularly good position to begin with, but nevertheless, many of those worsening trends will be detected much more in next year's index. But also in terms of the ranking of specific countries as they get worse, unfortunately, as you rightly point out, the situation in many countries is not good. And in that sense, we do see a bit of a traffic jam. When countries worsen, there does tend to be a bit of a jam at the top of the index. And that also contributes to why certain countries might be ranked perhaps better than what might otherwise seem the case. But also what I would encourage your listeners to do is to look at the decade trends of our index, because the rankings themselves are certainly a snapshot of a moment in time of where a country is scoring or ranking at this point in time. However, the decade trends really demonstrate whether that country is either getting better or getting worse over time. And so with the decade trends, it's probably of little surprise that countries like Libya and Syria and Mali and Yemen are worsening significantly and are the most worsened countries over the last 10 years. However, it's worth looking at the other end of the index and seeing that there's significant improvement in countries like Cuba or Bosnia and Herzegovina or Cape Verde. And countries like that, even though looking at the rankings for a particular year may not really raise too many flags, looking at the decade trends, we can really see improvement in those countries over the long term.
But when you were saying earlier, J.J. Mesner, about Europe becoming more fragile, most of the least fragile states are still in Europe, with, say, France at 158, and then Slovenia, UK at 162, Portugal, Belgium, Germany, Netherlands, Austria, Luxembourg, all down to 168, and then Sweden, 171. Ireland 172, Switzerland 174, Denmark and 175, and then Norway 177, and the least fragile on the planet at 178 is Finland. So by those measures, Europe's not doing too bad.
No, certainly the European countries are at a much more favorable starting point when we look at the trends than many countries in Africa or the Middle East, or also some countries in Latin America and Asia as well. But the trends, I think, really demonstrates that movement that may not necessarily be as evident in looking at the rankings as a standalone assessment.
Well, all the more ironic, this Brexit vote, which could unravel the EU. And the EU's major achievement has been to bring peace and security and prosperity to the continent of Europe that's seen two world wars in the last 100 years. Well, J.J. Mesner, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with J.J. Mesner, the Executive Director of the Fund for Peace, where he leads many of their security and human rights implementation programs, and they have just published their Fragile States Index of 2016. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.